from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, a conversation with author Tessa Hadley, whose new novel is Late in the Day, published by Harper. Tessa Hadley is the author of five highly praised novels: Accidents in the Home, which was longlisted for the Guardian First Book Award; Everything Will Be All Right; The Master Bedroom; The London Train, which was a New York Times notable book; and Clever Girl. She's also the author of two short story collections, Sunstroke and Married Love, which were New York Times notable books as well. Her stories appear regularly in The New Yorker, and she lives in London. Late in the Day concerns the lives of two close-knit couples who are irrevocably changed by an untimely death. Alexander and Christine, and Zachary and Lydia, have been friends since they first met in their 20s. 30 years later, Alex and Christine are spending a leisurely summer's evening at home when they receive a call from a distraught Lydia. She's at the hospital. Zach is dead. In the wake of this profound loss, the three friends find themselves unmoored. All agree that Zach, with his generous, grounded spirit, was the irreplaceable one they couldn't afford to lose. Inconsolable, Lydia moves in with Alex and Christine. But instead of loss bringing them closer, the three of them find over the following months that it warps their relationships as old entanglements and grievances rise from the past, and love and sorrow give way to anger and bitterness. Late in the Day explores the complex webs at the center of our most intimate relationships to expose how beneath the seemingly dependable arrangements we make for our lives lie infinite alternate configurations. The Washington Post has said that Tessa Hadley, quote, crystallizes the atmosphere of ordinary life in prose, somehow miraculous and natural. When I spoke with her last week, I mentioned that the situation set forth in Late in the Day seems very natural to me, a close and intact group of friends, two couples who've known each other for decades, suffering a loss and having to deal with that. But it was interesting to me that the novel was so fresh and unusual. I haven't seen books with this particular theme before, or not many. So I asked how she came to write it, and I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think the novel before, The Past, was a very sort of tight novel. Most of it was really within 3 weeks of one summer, although obviously all those, the people who are gathered together for their summer holiday in the country are thinking back to the past, and at one point the novel goes back to the past.
Right.
But really it was a very sort of small canvas that I worked into intently, so for some reason, I wanted to do something contrasting, and I thought I'm just interested in long marriage, really. And so I had an idea of these two couples, and from the beginning, I sort of thought, oh, A's with B, C's with D, but maybe at some point A was with C and B was with D, you know. Right. And I could imagine different phases of life when they would configure differently.
Right.
And then I thought, and then there's a blow. There's something terrible. One of them dies.
Yes.
And then I thought, I think the book has to begin with that. I didn't know that straight away. All of this thinking is before I began writing. But I thought at first that it would happen chronologically. And then as soon as I knew one of them would die, I kind of thought it would be wrong to have the book going along, as it were, innocently and then falling on its face with that catastrophe. It would feel manipulative somehow or just not right for managing in the narrative. And I knew that everything began with that scene where we hear that Zachary has died. And as soon as I thought that that should be at the beginning, I actually had the scene itself. I could imagine Christine and Alex sitting in that flat and right. The phone ringing. And I had it vividly to me. So I sort of, that was where it began.
And I'm so glad you did it that way, because to be honest, my favorite of the four was Zachary. I mean, I shouldn't say that maybe, but he just seemed like such a lovely person. I think I would have grieved terribly if I'd lost him halfway through.
It's funny, isn't it? That business of, I mean, upsetting one's readers, you know, in a way. it's all made up, it's all right. But I felt that. I thought it would be mean to have everybody like him and think how sweet he was. Whereas all the time now, in that wonderful trickery that a novel can carry off, we, the readers, know what's going to happen to him, but the people surrounding him don't know it at all. They're all living as we all live, you know, as if it will go on forever, or just blind, of course, to what the future holds. How can they be anything else? But we know. That's a funny sort of... It's one of the brilliant things about novels, is that you can do that. You can have that kind of magic, which isn't quite the same as the way we understand life.
Right, and actually, you know, now that I've said that, I'm also thinking, you know, maybe if it had been Christine who had been lost, or Lydia, or Alex, maybe then I would have seen Zachary up against this tragedy, and I would have seen him differently, and I would have thought, oh, really, she was my favorite character. So
that's really, something happens to somebody when they die, doesn't it? I mean, something, apart from the obvious, something happens in the imagination of everybody around. And, yeah, that's what happens in this book, in a way. And the book itself, almost, even when it's giving you what he's like, he's here, he's breathing, he's drinking and talking and lively, but we can't help seeing him in this with an aura of pastness because of what we know. And that's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wonder, before we talk any further, if you wouldn't mind reading that opening paragraph.
Okay. They were listening to music when the telephone rang. It was a summer's evening, 9 o'clock. They had finished supper and Christine was listening with intensity, sitting with her feet tucked under her in the armchair. She recognized the music, although she didn't know what it was. Alex had chosen it. He hadn't consulted her, and now she stubbornly wouldn't ask. He took too much pleasure in knowing what she didn't know. He lay on the sofa in the bay window with a book open in his hand, not reading it, the book dropped across his chest. He was watching the sky outside. Their flat was on the first floor, and the sitting room window looked out over a wide street lined with plane trees. A gang of parakeets zipped across from the park, and the purple-brown darkness of the copper beach next door fumed against the turquoise sky, swallowing the last light. A blackbird, silhouetted with open beak on a branch, must be singing, but the recorded music overrode it. It was the landline ringing.
Thank you. And maybe it's unfair to cut you off there, because it goes on beautifully, and we do learn what has happened to Zachary. But I had some thoughts about that opening paragraph that I wanted to talk about. One thing that I noticed was all of these sentences, and as I read on, it wasn't true of all of your prose, but in this opening paragraph, all of these sentences begin with subject, verb, object clauses. And, you know, they're connected by commas and semicolons, and they're more interesting than just that. But it slows us down in a way and really grounds us in the moment before they learn. And I wondered if that was purposeful.
What a lovely reader you are, by the way. People don't usually read at that level of... I don't think I had even noticed the actual syntactical structure, but of course I'm looking at it now and you're absolutely right. But you are right. I mean, I knew that I had, as it were, one paragraph or probably... Actually, there's another sort of page before she finds out what's happened. But one paragraph of this... present happiness and sweetness and ordinariness of life before the machinery of the story started up. So the intensity of the light and the scenery, that's not quite the right word for an interior, but, you know, outside the window and the stage setting of that room, I really did want it to be sort of powerful, to be then broken across.
All of the details are very vibrant. So in addition to the syntactical setup that helps ground us in that moment, there's just this beauty to it. Even though there's that little aside about how, you know, Alex, you know, he takes pleasure in knowing what she didn't know. But even that is very specific and, I don't know, it really takes us there.
I was thinking as I read it, actually, that little detail about how he took too much pleasure in knowing what she didn't know. And I was thinking, that isn't a serious accusation of him from her. It's that sort of play of mild antagonism that is ordinary and everyday, and then when the catastrophe strikes, it sort of shrivels, if you know what I mean, by contrast with the enormity of what's really happened. Those little tugs. And yet, you could also say, some little niggle in there becomes a small crack, which, as the novel proceeds, is going to open up into a crevasse between them.
Right. Well, and this is interesting, too, because, of course, you wrote the book, and I'm seeing things that maybe you didn't intend, but he likes to know things ahead of time, and yet she's the one who finds out about Zachary first.
Mm.
And afterward, Alex insists that they hear out the music to the end.
Yeah.
And that was so interesting to me. I just love your character development. I just felt so much like I knew who these people were.
It's funny, now you say that, of course, one of the things I do right when she comes down with the news, and you're right, she knows it and he doesn't, is she's almost appalled by knowing something he doesn't.
Yeah.
It's almost awful for her that she looks at his face and he doesn't know yet. I mean, that is something that happens sometimes in life when you have to bring very bad news to somebody. And you know it for a moment, and you wish you didn't have to spoil everything for them, but you know you do. So that's interesting. And then, after he makes that, somebody read that very, very early on when I, not even in a final draft, someone read that bit where he holds her still and makes her listen to the music and thought he was a monster. And I was very upset by that. That's not what I mean at all. I don't think he's monstrous when he holds her there and they let the music finish. I think they're different. Their instinctual movements in that crisis moment aren't the same, but it's kind of big in him that he says, listen to the music. That's what music's about. It's not something for happy times that we put off when real life happens. We can listen to it, and I kind of like him for that.
I saw him as drawn to ceremony in that moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And she's very English, I have to say. So she's sort of she shies away from gestures and ceremonies and with a sort of habitual irony. It's one of the problems between them, although problem really, if everything else hadn't happened, is too strong a word. It's just one of the differences between them.
Right.
She's got this sort of English reflexive withdrawal and irony, and he's got something rather continental, that ability to rise to the occasion and make the big gesture. And it's perfectly possible to like both those things in people.
Yeah. Now, I just love the way that you're able to present character through situation, I'll say, behavior, action, and reaction. And, the cliche is, show, don't tell. But your situations just show us who they are. So one of the examples of this is the character we haven't really discussed yet is Lydia. She was Zachary's wife, is Zachary's widow. And there's this point where she decides she doesn't want to see the body. She says it's not him anymore, so what's the point? Whereas Christine feels that in her shoes, she would want to see the body. She puts it that seeing Zachary's body would give form to her fear, but she's not judgmental at all. But anyway, so those sorts of moments, I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about establishing character and using those sorts of moments to let us see who people are.
I mean, when you begin to write, you have probably, well, I have anyway, in my notebook, I have some clues to these people. I have strong clues to them. I have already a sort of taste and flavor of them. But I don't really know them at the beginning of each scene until I've written the scene. It's sort of like, the difference between a note for something and then actually watching somebody doing the thing, I learn about them. So that's how it feels as I'm writing, if you know what I mean. I am discovering, I have a strong sense that Lydia's got this sort of theatricality, this slightly mannered behavior, isn't meek. I see all that in her, but I don't know what she's going to do in the room until I put her into it. I always think if I knew all that in advance, writing would not have, you know, it wouldn't have the joy that it does have, because it feels as if as you make each sentence, you're finding out what right. that scene was like and what it felt like and what that person does at that moment. So you don't really have their whole character in anticipation. It's as if you'd heard tell of these people and you had an idea of them, and then you meet them and then you see them doing this, and then you see them very differently in a different context doing that, and they surprise you. So yes, but sometimes, you know, I am sometimes telling that little bit about actually neither of the women would have wanted to see the body. I mean, for goodness sake, you know, probably who wouldn't be afraid of that in a way?
Right.
And yet Christine says herself, she says, I would have, the difference between us is I would have wanted to do it just to get rid of my fear. And Lydia acts on her superstitions. So I've never thought there was such a clear-cut barrier between showing and telling, almost like that thing you noticed right at the beginning where Alex likes knowing things that she didn't know. You know, I'm always supplying bits of information rather than just performing them. I love the way that prose in a novel can just meander between just showing, watching people moving, gesturing, appearing, and then you can say, he was like this.
Yeah.
He did this always. She right. thought that about him.
Sure.
And none of them are final. Nothing closes on the character. That's the great thing. No, you can say things in one sentence, and actually two chapters later, that person is behaving in a way that isn't really consistent with what you said, because that's what people are like.
Mm-hmm.
You can just go on changing. Cumulatively, adding on layers like onion skin sort of thing.
Yeah. Do you mind, Tessa, if I read a paragraph?
No.
Okay. So I really admired your description of how final and unexpected death can feel. And there's just this beautiful paragraph, if I may. I think it's fairly early in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There was something intolerable in the expectation in that room, strained around Zachary's absence, which could not be filled. The time when they might have been waiting for him to walk through the door was so recent, so close at hand, but it seemed vividly possible. They could imagine how he would make his entrance, noisy with the reassurances, full of jokes, puzzled by their glum faces. He was always so up to date on everything, so full of news. It seemed impossible he didn't know this latest fact, his own death. That so struck me. I mean, I just thought that was beautiful. First of all, because it is very specific to Zachary's character, but also anyone who's lost someone understands the extraordinary immediacy of that loss and the shock of it. And I just, I liked that.
And if that person is part of your sort of mental family, your emotional family, you can't believe they're not sharing it with you,
right.
that they're not surprised at having died and reacting to it. That's one of the ways you feel the absence, I
right.
think.
Right, yeah. And then there's the continued fallout from that, where you're continuously wanting to tell this person, oh my God, you can't believe how this guy is acting.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes.
Now, Christine and Lydia, I loved this. This made me think about something new, and I love when that happens. So they call themselves feminists, but you write that they had each chosen patterns of relationship with men which looked almost like their mother's marriages, dependent and sheltered. I loved thinking this about the feminism that was in between then and now. You know, I feel like part of what's changed is economy necessitates that in most families that's not even possible anymore. But I liked thinking about what that has done to feminism and how it's changed. Were you thinking a lot about that?
Well, it probably is something I've thought about quite a bit, because I think I belong to that transitional generation.
Yeah, me too.
And actually, for instance, when I had my small children, I didn't work. And I don't think my daughters-in-law could imagine that now.
Right.
You know, they are at least as busy as my sons. In fact, I sometimes worry that men have a sort of inherited gift for taking things easy and not overdoing it, and that women, you know, work so hard they make themselves ill. So that's just a thought. I don't know how true it is. But anecdotally, in my family, I would say, you know, the men have a sort of knack for being laid back, which my lovely daughters-in-law haven't all perfected yet.
Right.
Anyway, so I'm the lazy generation. I've definitely had, you know, I have no sense that women are subordinate or that my role has been to support men or anything like that. Very indifferent, strikingly different to my mother, though we're very close and I'm very interested in how she is. But I did stay at home, and what I was doing when I was staying at home was writing, but I can't say I did it with any very realistic prospect of ever making a living at it or success of it at all. It was all rather disastrous and shameful and private, and, you know, ostensibly I was a housewife. So, and my best friend, not totally dissimilar, and a bit of, you know, a bit of part-time work, and We were still doing that thing women have done, bourgeois women anyway, because working class women have usually worked.
Right.
Which is dreaming and thinking a lot and talking to each other and meandering around with our children. And nobody's saying that childcare isn't hard work, because it is. But, you know, they go to school all day.
Right.
Funny. So something transitional and odd. And you're quite right. I'm not sure that's quite possible. I mean, there is some underpinning socioeconomic story which really says the whole joke of the revolution that means women are working towards parity at work now is that, well, that was very good for capitalism, wasn't it? To double their workforce while actually, you know, now a household needs two workers.
Yeah.
And it used to only need one. Right. So, you know, nobody could wish to undo that revolution. But there are some cons in it as well, in that now we perhaps have two people working very hard, sometimes too hard, without enough time for dreaming. It's a little bit of me is just clings to that space women of a certain privileged kind have had for a long time, of kind of, even if they were working, doing bits of work not being at the center of their selves. That's, I don't mean by that creative work, because I suppose you could say my whole novel is actually about the centrality of creative work to this woman, this artist, Christine. But
yes.
She is not sort of, I don't know. The search for who she is doesn't feel pressured in the way that perhaps her husband, who is not dissimilar in that he won't make up his mind for a long time, but the pressure's on Alex so much more.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Right.
Who are you? Nobody's really asking Christine that. They're waiting to let her become whatever she becomes.
Exactly, right. And whatever it is will be a pleasant surprise to everybody around her.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Well, actually, now that you've mentioned that she's an artist, I have a question about that. So she is an artist, and in the moments just after learning of Zachary's death, she passes by her studio and thinks about how her creative work feels vain and fraudulent all of a sudden, even though she loves her work. But I wonder if that's a danger for all artists, do you think, that our work is one of the first things we question when we're faced with something that seems, you know, sort of more important because it's real?
Mm. Do you know, I think I almost borrowed that detail from something I'd read. I don't even know how consciously I did that now. I read a lovely, terrible book by a woman who was an artist, who was married to Tom Lubbock, the art historian, who had a terrible brain tumor and died of it over a couple of years. It's a very beautiful book called The Iceberg. I don't know whether it was published in America. And I remember that she, early on in his illness, shuts up her studio and that it sickens her and that she can't go near it or back to it, including after he's died for a long time. And I didn't just pick it up because I thought, oh, it must be real. And I could so imagine. Yeah, I think an artist, and I don't know whether this is more true of a woman artist. I have no idea about that. It's an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm.
Would feel, you can feel a kind of shame at your art because it's not life. I mean, I imagine this, you know, if a child was sick, you would feel it's the sort of the total absorption and submersion in art that maybe it is that women artists find that shaming sometimes when it's put to the test, when suddenly life or death or sickness kind of intrudes. You don't feel, oh well, but I must do my work. You feel sort of ashamed of that game,
right?
The playfulness of work, creative work,
right?
And you have to earn your way back into it. And I don't know, I mean, that's what the whole novel sort of follows in a way with Christine, the time it takes to earn her way to the point when she can go back.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about creating art for fictional artists? Like, you gave her a whole discipline, and I wondered how much of a background you had in art.
Mm. Not really. I mean, my mum is actually a really strikingly rather good artist, but totally, totally for herself.
Okay.
That's another story to do with a different generation. She has never shown or sold one of her lovely still lives, but they're very, very good anyway. I asked her a thing or two, but actually not probably as much almost as I should have done. I didn't really know. I knew it couldn't be writing. I don't know why. It's hard. It would have been too self-referential.
Yes.
Somehow. It was too close. I knew she was a visual artist. And I think I had a very dutiful sense when I set out of how much research I would do. I always have this dutiful sense. Sort of afterwards, I would check it all. And then I just had a hunch. I mean, I love painting. I love the visual arts. Without doing it at all, without practicing it, but as a viewer and a fan, I love it. So I just, to be honest, kind of made it up, then read some things, read enough to get what I hoped was an intuitive detail here and there.
Right.
And I sort of am that kind of writer, I think. I do bits of research, but I often find the more you research, the more something becomes wooden. This would be very different if you were writing, you know, a historical novel set in the early 19th century. Or would it? I don't know. That can sound wooden too. Maybe intuitive guessing is really, that's the first task of the novelist always. And, you know, don't be an idiot about it. Check that you haven't made stupid mistakes, sort of thing.
Right. I remember interviewing someone about a depiction that they did of a mentally ill character, and she said a very similar thing. She didn't diagnose her character. She didn't read, you know, a list of symptoms and give them to him. She just wanted it to be more organic than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that
makes
sense.
I wonder if that was Sam Harvey, because I know my friend and actual colleague, Samantha Harvey, who wrote The Wilderness about dementia, she said that. You just brought it back into my head as you spoke.
Oh, interesting.
She said that she didn't do any research or read anything about Alzheimer's, or I think he has Alzheimer's, the character. She just did it out of... It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where does that stuff come from?
Yeah, it was the American author Mary McGarry Morris. I don't know if you've heard of her, but...
I haven't read that, but I've heard of her.
Yeah. All right, so one thing I loved, or I don't know, it was interesting to me. The person who you removed from this group is the one who always made sure everyone else was happy.
Yeah.
That to me was very important. You left behind the people who would maybe least know how to cope.
Yes. I think, and they even say that themselves, don't they?
So.
They even say, he's the one we couldn't afford to lose.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have a question there, but I thought that was, I don't know, there are certain things I just admired about this book, and that was one of them. It was just a way to create a more interesting narrative.
Mm, yes. See, because I think that can happen. I think there are enablers among us.
Yes.
To use a sort of slightly clumsy word, who smooth the world out for the more awkward ones around them. And really, if they are, for any reason, suddenly removed, the rest are stuck. And yet you could say that the very painful reconfigurations and sort of agonies that the remaining three go through, perhaps it's more right eventually, you know. Uh-huh. Maybe Zachary was holding something in place that needed to fall apart. I don't know. Yeah. There is no such thing as a truth about things like that. You can tell it one way or tell it another, and there's no final verdict to be delivered.
Well, especially you can. I wondered if you began with the characters as they are in chapter one, or did you start with them as younger friends? Like, as you began actually putting words to paper, is this sort of how it went?
Yeah, I began with them at the beginning. I always write chronologically. Not chronologically, that's not what I mean. I always write from page one through. Now, of course, you know, that gets changed as I go back over it or whatever. But no, I didn't. I did begin with them in their 50s and the shock of the death. And then from there, I went back into finding them as their younger selves. And again, like as I said before, I had outlines of what those young selves were like. But so much actually comes to you as you write. I always have some sketches in my notebook, but I don't know. You know, it's amazing, this sort of miracle. This is, again, talking about something intuitive, where you're writing down the man on the page, and this comes to you, that this would be true about him, and his father would be this, and his... I can't remember when I thought that Alex would have this novelist father who had been silenced by exile. As soon as I did know it, I think I did actually know that before I began.
Right.
I think that feels so fundamental. But it's like it's one of those clues that feels very, very giving in relation to his character and who he is and where he's stuck and all of that.
Yeah.
So no, I did. I wrote the book in absolutely the order you have it there.
Okay. All right. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the challenge of representing their interdependence, but at the same time, their need to be free of one another. That seems to be a theme in the book.
Yeah, more for some than others. I mean, you do feel Christine sort of, in the later stages, struggling to some extent to free herself, whereas Lydia is, she needs a man in an old-fashioned way.
Right.
She's more old-fashioned in a sense. I mean, they say somewhere that she's like some old-fashioned aristocrat. I think, yeah. Christine says that as a compliment. You said she knows how to be indolent. Here are all the rest of us kind of running around feeling guilty, and she knows how to do nothing. And then later, when Alex is thinking about Lydia, when he's, you know, properly involved with her, he starts to think that he makes this comparison of her, which I remember I found very suggestive at the time. I worked on it a lot. I overwrote it at first, and I may have reduced it to not all that much, but he thinks she's like a mistress in the olden days who in one sense had nothing to do but wait for a man to come. But wasn't that really rather admirable and extraordinary? Not admirable, that's the wrong word, but extraordinary. Maybe that was a more intense way of being alive than the bankers and politicians and lawyers who were, you know, bound to their wheel of importance and activity and, you know, being somebody. And instead, it relates back to that thought about men and women that we were talking about right at the beginning. You know, women just looking in their mirrors all day and having their baths and trying on their clothes, all the things we've been taught to deplore, but maybe it was mysterious too. You had a lot of time for self-contemplation. So that's what Lydia's like.
Yeah.
What was your original question? I'm sorry.
No. Well, it just seemed like it would be a challenge to present them as being so interdependent, so relying on each other. And maybe this kind of relates back to the fact that Zachary, you know, held them all together. And then it seems like they also kind of need, at least, as you say, maybe not all of them, but some of them really kind of need to also step away from one another at times. And I wondered if that was a push-pull in the writing.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like people, doesn't it?
It does.
Sounds like families.
Absolutely.
And friends.
Yeah.
Exactly that push-pull, as you say, drawing them together and then pushing them apart. And sometimes they're good for each other and sometimes maybe they're not.
Okay.
That seems, I mean, it's a good theme to write about, of course, because what you get is the variation. It's what you don't want to write about is a steady state.
Right.
To have material to have change between them is what you're looking forward to.
Right.
And that was an idea very early on, even before I knew I would begin with the death, was to have, you know, them sort of having all sorts of surprises of how A was with B, and then it turned out that B had been with D and so on. And is it all right to have a spoiler here? It doesn't matter if I spoil the story.
It's up to you.
Or do you want me? maybe I shouldn't. No, I won't say anything about that then.
Okay.
I'll keep that little... there is a little sort of secret surprise, I hope, that would surprise the reader.
Yeah, I wasn't going to spoil anything either.
But I think you're right. You're right. Shouldn't know it in advance.
Let's see. Well, I'm curious now, you've mentioned that a couple times, that you were thinking about how this would play out before you started writing it. Obviously, of course, you were. But I'm wondering, you know, how long were you mulling over the structure of the book before you began actually writing it and figuring out that he would die at the beginning instead of sticking with them?
It's sort of very, it's not the kind of business-like thinking one might think you would need. What I seem to do is that while I'm writing one novel, so I'm really absorbed in the minutiae and the forward slow movement of the past. That was the last novel which I was writing. I kind of feel, almost for my own safety, that I have to start having the idea of the next novel. It would feel so panic-inducing to come out of one and not have a clue what you were going to do next.
Sure.
So... But at the same time, this is not a matter of making big notes or doing any work. It's a matter of daydreaming, really, and you with this lovely feeling of irresponsibility. So if you suddenly decide, actually, this isn't going to work, I don't like this, and that happens, then you can throw it all away because nothing's been expended on it. And I think it's in that interval of no cost, no responsibility. It doesn't matter whether it's any good or not. Just play with this lovely idea that seems to have seized you and poke at it and run it through different configurations. That, in fact, it's almost like you trick yourself, because that is invaluable time for writing.
Yeah.
Because it's once you feel the pressure on and you've started and you've got this much done behind you and, oh, that bit's turning out to be, I don't like it, it's awkward, I'm not convinced by this, you know, how am I going to handle that? That's quite inhibiting. It's much harder to think really with inspiration and fun and pleasure in it at that point. No, it is still very pleasurable.
Yeah.
But if you've got the big shapes and some inspired kind of surprises, oh, I could do that, why don't I try that, you know? In this period when it doesn't matter, when you can throw it away or you can throw that bit away, that's what it will have been like. And then I would have a notebook and I would start jotting things down, but very loosely.
Yeah.
So I'm not at all a meticulous planner, but at the same time, I did have that. I had to have the structure worked out, obviously. And once I decided to begin with the death, I had to think, so how will I do it then? How will I do the rest? And then I came up with that sort of four parts which are in the present of the death and the mourning and so on, and then dipping back three times into their past, once in their 20s, once in their 30s, once in their 40s. I had to have, I mean, I hope as you were reading, you wouldn't have been aware of it with any sort of, you know, no. neatness like I've just described it. But as the writer, you sort of have to have that, you know, under your belt and sorted. I knew I had to do that. So at some point, there is a little wobbly sketch in a notebook that has a thing dipping in and out. But, you know, that's actually the work of half an hour.
Right.
Thinking, well, how'd I do that? How'd I do that? What's the way? Would that work? Yeah. You scribble it down. And yeah.
And so, then once you start writing, are you someone who flies through a first draft and then gets to a revision point? Or are you somebody who sort of worries over each word and keeps going back?
The second thing.
The second.
I don't fly at all. I'm very slow. And there is no first draft. I mean, obvious there is, in the sense that when I get to the end, there will be lots more work to do because some bits are too long and some bits are not good enough and maybe that's a bit lumpy. And I have a brilliant editor at HarperCollins who's very, so Jennifer Bath, who's so fantastic at knowing, saying, this bit's not quite good enough. Can you do something better with this? Or there's a scene missing here. Feels a bit flat, you know. So I'm not at all precious about it. But as I'm writing, I pretty much think this is it. This is how it will be. And every sentence is sentence-y. It's not a sketch in any sense. I there's no virtue in working like that. So many of the writers I love best don't, you know, they do write a sort of thinner first draft and then fill in afterwards. But for some reason, that isn't what I do. I'm writing very, you know, finally, as if this was it.
Right.
And then I do some rewriting afterwards, but not vast.
Okay.
Actually.
All right. Tessa, what are a couple of books maybe that you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
I've just read a wonderful Hungarian book, but I think it's in print in America, which is by a woman, is written in the 60s by Agata Kristof, Agota Kristof. And her book's called The Notebook, and it's the most extraordinary thing about two twin boys who are delivered to their grandmother in the crisis of war. And their grandmother is a pretty terrifying old woman in the country. And these boys, it's marvelous. They sort of learn to survive. It's a great book. And very,
that sounds
very
great.
Fine.
All right.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And I've also just read Colm Tobin's House of Names, which is, that's set in the Trojan War, and it's based on the great legends of the murder of Agamemnon and so on. And I thought I wouldn't like it because I'm a bit of a sort of presentist reader, and I thought it would be legendy. I love Colm, by the way. He's one of my absolute great contemporary writers, and it is marvelous.
Okay.
Strange. Talk about working intuitively and being able to intuit things you should not be able to know about the distant past. That's him. Anyway.
Okay, great.
They're both quite grim, actually. I warn you, and I do love sunny books as well. I just happen, maybe it was a counteractive to Christmas, surrounded by lovely jollity and family and presents. I felt I needed something sort of dark and dour.
Okay. Where is my copy of The Name of the Rose?
Exactly.
What are you writing now, Tessa, or are you in between projects?
Well, no, I have done the same thing again because I was afraid of finishing late in the day and not having a new one. So I have actually started a new book, which I've only done the first portion of. But I'm kind of excited about it so far, which is, it's new for me. It's all set in the past, not the deep past. It's the 1960s. So it's not the past. It's still a time I can remember, though I was a child.
Yeah.
And these are, it's not about children, or at least there are children in it, but it's about them. Yeah, it's about the hinge between an old world of conforming and respectability and, you know, the familiar 1960s thing.
Great. Yeah.
So, That's where I am at the moment.
Oh, wonderful. So my last question is always for advice. So a lot of my listeners are writers. So I wonder if you can offer advice for creating sort of vivid and relatable characters, the kind of characters I felt you did very well in Late in the Day, your new novel.
Do you know, I think one thing that's important to me, not to every writer, but to me, when I'm making a character, is I have to know them physically. Mm. I have to know what they look like. And it is very, very hard writing on the page what people look like.
Yeah.
So I would think, I have in the past set this for students, and it's very interesting, to really work on describing somebody's physical presence, and you must do it with no intention of showing them. This must not be flattering or sweet. It must be truthful and naked. Not literally naked, although, if you want, that's fine too. But sort of something where you try to literally just catch that person's presence in a room, their aura. You have to register, are they lovely? Does everyone turn to look at them, or are they hidden, meek, you know, whatever. Work really hard at it, and it has personality qualities as well as the actual, you know, are they tall or short and fat? That's almost less important, though it needs to be in there too.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I love. Well, and the other thing that I do at the end of the show is I offer a writing prompt for listeners who are writers. So maybe, if with your permission, I'll use that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a good one. And I think the really crucial thing is don't show it to the person you're describing. Another hint, by the way, is I once did it with students, and I wanted to think they were going to, I said, write it first with your eye, not literally with your eyes shut, without looking at the person. Then look at them and write it. And I thought the second thing was going to be better than the first. And in a wonderful experiment, it proved the other way around.
Oh, wow.
Not looking was actually better. What you did in your imagination, thinking about that person. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, so you had your students pair up and describe each other. Is that how you did
Yes,
it?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And without showing each other afterwards what they'd said. So it was a private exercise. It had to be in order to be truthful, because otherwise people would hold back.
Yeah, right. Oh, wonderful. Okay, I love that.
There we are.
Thank you.
I hope it doesn't cause any terrible breakdown
of
relationship.
No, it'll be fine. All right, so I just want to mention again, the name of the novel is Late in the Day, and the novel is by Tessa Hadley and published by Harper. Thank you so much, Tessa. I've really enjoyed our conversation today.
Oh, I have too. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Tessa Hadley, author of Late in the Day, which is published by Harper. You can learn more at her publisher's website, harpercollins.com. So, as you just heard us say in the interview, this week's Write the Book prompt has to do with what Tessa Hadley said she needs to know about her characters in order to develop them. And that is, she needs to know what they look like, who they are physically. And she has set an exercise to students in the past in which they pair up and write physical descriptions of each other. So this week, write a physical description of someone you know well, or at least can get a really good look at, and do not let that person see the outcome of your efforts. That's one of the things Tessa said, this last instruction. Not sharing the outcome is imperative, ensuring that you will keep the physical description that you write honest. So good luck with your work in the coming week, and stay tuned next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know archived episodes are available on iTunes and at ratethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. We're also on Twitter. The Twitter username is Write the Book. And on Facebook. And you can access the podcast at my own website as well. My own website you can get to at shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest that you'd like to suggest, some author whose work you absolutely love and wish that I would get in touch and talk to them about their book, or if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And let me I say that every week. Maybe it becomes kind of like a little hypnotic because I say the same thing every week. But it's truly, like, if you're an author and you have a reading coming up and you'd like to have it mentioned on the air, just send me an email, and I will put it in the Bookworm's calendar in the Monday preceding that event. If you like Write the Book, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tweet about it, share the episodes, you know, go to the podcast site and share each of our episodes that you love. Tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week. Thank you.